From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection was made just 1 hour ago at a mobile COVID-19 vaccine clinic. This clinic is one of many that have been set up in recent weeks for patients with intellectual and developmental disabilities and those with lifelong complex health conditions. Local doctors noticed a gap in access for these patients when vaccines first became available, and they sprung into action to mobilize clinics. Since then, Dr. Tiffany Pulsino and her team have helped more than 2,000 patients with disabilities and with complex medical conditions get the vaccines. The team also arranged for clinics at local community organizations that serve these patients, Hillside, Heritage Christian Services, and others. This hour, we talk about these efforts and about the challenges that the pandemic has presented to people with disabilities, from access to health care and vaccines, issues related to isolation from support systems, and more. This is part of WXXI's Inclusion Desk, spotlighting issues related to disabilities. And I'd like to welcome our guests now. Dr. Tiffany Pulsino is the medical director of the UR Medicine Complex Care Center. Dr. Pulsino, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Michelle Labassier-Hall is with us. Michelle is Associate Vice President of Customized Support at Heritage Christian Services. Michelle, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Stephanie Ramos, advocate and patient of Dr. Pulsino. Stephanie, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Pulsino, let me just read a little bit from NPR's reporting in February on this. NPR reported, quote, early studies have shown that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities have a higher likelihood of dying from the virus than those without disabilities, likely because of a higher prevalence of pre-existing conditions. While some high-profile outbreaks make the news, a lack of federal tracking means the population remains largely overlooked amid the pandemic. No one knows how many of the estimated hundreds of thousands of people who live in facilities nationwide have caught COVID-19 or died as a result. That creates a blind spot in understanding the impact of the virus. And because data drives access to scarce COVID-19 vaccines, those with disabilities could be at a disadvantage for getting prioritized for the shots to keep them safe, end quote. How serious an issue is this, Dr. Pulsino?
Well, thank you for asking, Evan, and that was a very nice summary by NPR last month. You know, just as everything else during this pandemic, healthcare providers and researchers and publishers of healthcare information are doing their best to keep up from the reality of what we're seeing every day. And even since February, there's been a robust blossoming of literature that now this is a much more present awareness in the country that people with IDD are at highest risk for complications and death from COVID-19. It just came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, in fact, this month. So while we're trying our best to keep up, fortunately in this community, we have a great collaboration with our community partners. And we were very aware of this complication from COVID-19 for our community and those we support with IDD and other complex medical conditions because we talked to each other. So we were able to be front and center in addressing this access gap early on because we have that communication and collaboration here in Rochester.
We talked to people with disabilities in a forum for WXXI News on television late into the summer, into the fall. And the concern that they expressed was very direct. Several of the participants in that forum, Dr. Pulsino, told us outright, they said, I'm worried that if I get COVID, I will die. And mm-hmm. I mean, that shakes you up just to hear that. But I think the data bears out the fact that I'm not saying everyone with a disability, thank God, dies when they get COVID, but the fear that this community has is not unjustified, I think is now fair to say. Does the data back that up?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Michelle Labassier-Hall, Associate Vice President of Customized Support at Heritage Christian Services. Can you tell me how you view, you know, what we've learned about this pandemic in the last year, and especially for people who may not always have access to resources and are certainly concerned about outcomes here?
Yeah, certainly. I think one of the unique features that, you know, Dr. Pulsino touched on is our community coming together. And we did that, I think, started to do that long before the vaccines were even approved. So, you know, probably November, December, started to think about how we would respond to making sure that folks with disabilities had access to the vaccine. One of the things the mobile clinic has really done is broken down a lot of the barriers to access. and made it a reality to come to a familiar place with people who were able to accommodate your needs and accommodate the staffing needs that might need to be present in order for that person to be successful with being vaccinated.
Yeah, in a moment we're going to get Stephanie's story, but I want to talk about how these clinics have come together. And Dr. Pulsino, what was your process here? How did you begin to organize these vaccine clinics?
Well, just like everything during the pandemic, we identified that bringing people with complex sensory issues and intellectual and developmental disabilities that made mobility perhaps a more challenging situation, and as Michelle articulated, needing staff to support them, going to a site, finding a slot on a website to register for a vaccine was going to create a huge burden. So to create real access, we needed to remove that burden. So when we identified how vaccine would be distributed in this community early on, we identified that would not work for this population who really needed it as fast as possible, just like people in nursing homes. So we looked to identify what setting could they receive the vaccine in which they would be, it would be easy for both their staff and the clients that they're serving, and then talk to our leadership at URMC and the Finger Lakes Vaccine Hub, who were fully supportive and said, go do the thing. So we worked with our community partners. We engaged in a needs assessment to say, what do you need and how can we deliver it to you so it serves the people you're supporting best? And they gave us what they needed. We brought bins of supplies. We traveled to over 45 group homes in a variety of community settings with a bevy of 86 volunteers from the URMC system, nurses, support people, physicians, to go to wherever the client needed them, wherever the staff were available, and vaccinate them. And that was over a three-month period. So it really was a community effort and a lot of support from the leadership in this community, both at the University of Rochester, the Vaccine Hub, and our community-based partners.
Are you yourself, Dr. Pulsino, doing some of the vaccinating?
I am. When I have a moment, I usually get out about once a week to vaccinate. Those are my favorite days.
I was going to say, see, that's what I wanted to talk about. You know? I have to imagine that this is, in many ways, a joyful thing to do, and maybe, hopefully, a joyful thing for those who get the chance to get vaccinated. What have you experienced, Doctor?
It is. I cannot tell you the emotional relief it brings to watch somebody who's been sequestered in their group home for their own safety wheel up in a power chair with their support staff that have been at their side throughout this pandemic, have them roll up their sleeves, give them their vaccine, and hear them hooray to say, I'm finally going to get out again. I'm going to see my friends. I'm going to be able to do the things that I enjoy. And watch their staff, who have supported them throughout this pandemic, watched other people go to the hospital and pass away from COVID-19, tear up and be so joyful that they're able to support and protect the people that they're supporting all day long. It's hard to even put into words. Clearly I'm struggling with that now.
Michelle, what have you sort of noticed about this process and some of the emotions involved?
I would echo Dr. Pulsino's sentiments that it is typically, I will staff the clinics as well, just from an organizational perspective, and it is absolutely very rewarding for me. I loved a few of the times that I saw some of the residents being supported and really cheering on and expressing what it is they wanted to get back to. I picture a young gentleman with a University of Rochester sign in front of him expressing why it is he got vaccinated, because he is thrilled to be able to get back to work. And he wants the independence and the experiences that come with getting back to work. So there have been lots of those moments for both staff and the people supported.
It's the best. I love hearing those. Those stories have not gotten old to me for one second. The joy. People post vaccine pics. They share. Keep doing it. It is what I think is giving so much joy and love and hope. And you know, if you go back a year, it's easy to forget that 1 year ago this week, what we were starting to see around the country, especially in cities like New York City, Atlanta, New Orleans, Seattle, there would be public cheering for nurses at shift changes at hospitals. There were people would open up their window and salute and cheer the medical teams who were dealing with these first weeks of the spike and surge of the pandemic in this country. And a year later, it's like we've forgotten that. And so now this hour, I just take such joy and pleasure in finding out some of the great work that's not only happening community-wide, but specifically that is helping people who might not have access otherwise. So I just hope, I don't know, Dr. Pulsina, do you feel like the love and the goodwill waned a little bit throughout this pandemic for the medical community?
I think we all experience fatigue. You can only mobilize that much emotional energy for so long. You have to support yourself in addition to all those around you. And it's been a year. You know, it's hard to support everybody else in addition to getting through your own day. So I think it waned, but it didn't come with any animosity. It's just we were all getting our heads down and doing what needed to be done. This just gives us a new recharge. You know, being able to go out and vaccinate people in a way that's accessible to them in a real way gives us a recharge for that emotional energy so we can reach out to others again and support each other. It really is so critical this far in that we have that opportunity to support each other.
Well, I want to talk to Stephanie Ramos, who is an advocate and a patient of Dr. Pulsina, who has a remarkable story. Stephanie, how are you today, by the way?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking.
Your second vaccine dose is later today. Is that right?
Yes, and I'm excited for it.
Oh, yeah, that is great. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So you're, 31 years old now?
Yes.
And you first met Dr. Pulsina when you were a teenager, yeah?
Yes, when I was 18 years old.
Tell us what was happening.
So I was born with sickle cell disease. It is a blood disease. So I was turning 18 years old, very nervous to meet a new doctor. And I meet Dr. Pulsina, this amazing woman, and I've just been attached to her since then. So we've been on a long journey, and I'm grateful for her. She goes beyond the duty of what a doctor is supposed to do for her patients.
When you first heard the term sickle cell, what do you remember about hearing sickle cell disease and how much you knew about it or didn't know about it?
So with sickle cell disease, that's something that you have from birth. So I've had it my whole life. So that's a tricky question. You know, you hear a lot of the negative stuff, especially back then, you know, not living past a certain age, not able to achieve certain things. And I'm happy to say that I beat all those barriers. Where 7 years ago, I'm just going to celebrate 7 years, I had a bone marrow transplant for sickle cell disease with the help of Dr. Pulsina by my side. So I lived through it. I lived through the disease, the bone marrow transplant process, and still going forth with it now. It's been a journey.
2015, you became who? Let me ask you a trivia question, Stephanie. Who was the first adult in Rochester to be cured of sickle cell disease?
Possibly me.
I think it's you,
Dr. Pulsina.
Dr. Pulsina, can you help us out with that?
That's true. Yeah.
Is that amazing?
That is true.
So, Dr. Pulsina, for listeners who don't know much about sickle cell, let's talk about what it is. Take our audience through it.
Sure. Sickle cell disease, as Stephanie articulated, is something people are born with. It's part of the genetic makeup that they're born with. It's a blood-borne disorder in which the red blood cells, the things that bring oxygen from your lungs to the rest of your body, because every organ and cell in your body needs oxygen, are not formed in the round, flexible way as everyone else's. They're not flexible, and so they can't move through small spaces easily. Over time, when those cells roll through the blood vessels, that causes damage to the blood vessels and any stress that a person feels, emotional, cold versus hot weather, they get sick with something, can cause that to worsen. Those blood vessels get tighter so that they can't move through as easily. There's more inflammation, and so things get stuck. We call that a crisis. Those are unpredictable and uncontrollable from the person who has sickle cell disease. They're painful, but they don't show up on the outside. You can't look at someone with sickle cell and say, you're in the middle of a crisis. So for children with sickle cell, they often express pain like everybody else does, but over years and years of having these painful events that can't predict, people learn very quickly to be able to manage it without showing it on the outside and get through their day. So many of the adults I care for with sickle cell disease go through a day with pain that I can't even imagine, akin to something like walking on a broken leg. And that's what Stephanie had to experience for many, many years. But they manage it because if they didn't, they wouldn't have a life to live. They'd be in their bed all the time and trying to cope with pain. So they're incredibly strong people as a group. They do things every day that I can't even imagine getting through. and the disease itself has made significant progress in treatment and research in the last 10 years. So Steph was the first patient in Rochester to get a bone marrow transplant to cure sickle cell disease.
Wow.
But on the horizon, we really have a lot of hope for gene therapies to cure this disorder. And many of my patients are engaging in research studies to assess that and how well that can work.
All right. So forgive the ignorant questions I have, doctor, but I suspect our audience may be wondering the same here. So does it always manifest in pretty consistent ways, or is it different person to person?
So because it's a blood disorder, that's a very good question. Because it's in your blood and your blood touches everything in your body, the ramifications of the disease can be in any organ or skin or bone or your eyes or your heart or your kidneys. So there's lots of different complications that can happen from the disease over time, and it varies from person to person. So sometimes you can have poor blood supply to your bones. Bones are organs just like everything else in your body. They need blood and they need oxygen and nutrients, and when they don't get it, they dissolve and they break. So people develop what's called avascular necrosis, in which they develop fractures and collapse of their bone. So it is, in reality, like walking on a broken leg. They can develop complications such as strokes or heart failure because their heart or their brain are not getting good blood supply, and the list goes on. So there's a because your blood is everywhere in your body and it's a critical component to keeping organs healthy, it can have multiple complications and very different from person to person.
Wow. I mean, just reading what some people with it go through and hearing these stories, it's very difficult. How often do you see it? I mean, do we know what the prevalence is? If I missed that, Dr. Pulsino?
I can't quote you the prevalence off the top of my head. It is more common in those of African-American, Mediterranean, and Middle Eastern descent because it came from that part of the world when it started as a genetic mutation. It's now much more prevalent across multiple ethnicities because we're all a mixing pot of all sorts of things genetically. So I apologize, I can't quote you the exact predominance of sickle cell disease, but in the Rochester area, there are about 560 people with the disorder in the Finger Lakes region.
Okay, and I'm thinking about, you know, kids who are going through pain and parents and family not knowing why and the confusion that must be there. That there has to be tremendous emotional turmoil for families that don't understand what's wrong. Is that
well,
right?
The good news is in New York State, this is part of our newborn screening process. So we do diagnose it either before a child is born or soon thereafter.
There's no cases out there where people wouldn't know.
No, it would be very rare. If they were not born in the United States, that is a possibility. But in the U.S., it is diagnosed usually before or right after birth.
Okay. Now, once you have a diagnosis, and parents, I'm sure, are nervous about what that means, what is the game plan now, and how has that changed?
So in the Finger Lakes region, that result of the test would go to our pediatric hematology specialists, our specialists in blood disorders for children. They get notified of a child being diagnosed with the disorder based on that national screening, and they call families and see them right away. And they start that educational process about what this is, what the treatments are today, and what we're hoping for in the future. Now, I take care of young adults and adults with sickle cell disease. So the story that people like Stephanie heard when they were 4, 5, and 6 is not the reality of care today. So it's a complex learning curve for families, and it changes year over year as medicine progresses. So I am certain when Stephanie was 5, 6, and 7, her mom was not hearing about bone marrow transplant as a cure for this disease mm-hmm. or the complications she was going to have at 30. So it's a constant learning process, and that's why healthcare really has to make sure that access is real and achievable for someone and never loses a beat over the course of their life because it is constantly evolving as the body ages.
Okay. Stephanie, let me ask you about what life was like with sickle cell. What was childhood like for you?
Oh, wow. So from what I can remember, my mom always tried to make it as normal as possible. She never tried to treat me different than my siblings. But I, unfortunately, was different from my siblings and my peers. With sickle cell, as Dr. Pulsino has stated, it's unpredictable. So there could be moments when I'm just playing with friends and all of a sudden I start having pain and then it increases. So I know that means I need to go home. I need to do my steps, which is get heat on it, take pain medication, keep watch on it. So we always had a plan. With sickle cell, you learn to be very organized, or you try to be an organized plan person as much as you can, because of it being so unpredictable. But even with the disease, I can say I had a normal childhood. It's just unfortunately, you know, had hospital stays and some scary nights. But, you know, I was still a kid. I was still a kid. There was tough moments, maybe not understanding fully why, you know, I'm the one that's dealing with this, vice versa, someone else. It took me up to my adulthood to actually meet other people with sickle cell disease in Rochester. So for a very long time, I always kind of felt alone in that lane. But luckily now I'm able to speak to so many different people through social media all across the United States and even outside of the United States. So I find that very refreshing to be able to communicate with so many different people now.
What was it like for you to finally meet an adult who'd been through what you went through? Did you compare stories? I mean, what was it like for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Once again, social media, it's this amazing thing, connecting people at so many different levels with so many different conditions. Just meeting, speaking to someone outside of Rochester, and then also the development of our sickle cell support group from U of R, meeting these families and to say that, you know, they're just like me, it's refreshing. It's nice. It gives you that I'm not alone a feeling. And I, as just me being me, all I ever want to do is give the tools that I've used growing up to others, you know, giving pointers and tips and to try to make their life a little bit easier as much as, you know, I can help. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about helping each other in the long run to kind of fight against the disease, you know, try to help each other live a better life as much as we can.
Absolutely. Yeah. And do you now, when you hear doctors now ask, because doctors sometimes or nurses sometimes will ask, or even loved ones will say to a family member who's struggling with something, you know, rate your pain on a scale of 0 to 10. Your standard for pain, Stephanie, has to be different than mine. I mean, I'm not trying to be flippant or insincere mm-hmm. about it. I don't handle pain well. That's just something I know about myself. And you seem to me to be probably someone who handles it, because you had to for so long, so much better than I can probably even imagine myself doing. Do you consider yourself someone who handles pain well?
I don't, actually.
No, come on.
I don't. I joke with my family when it comes to certain, because, you know, people don't realize there's different levels of pain. There's different types of pain. You know, there's a whole spectrum of it. So I do believe with a lot of things, yes, I'm strong. But when it comes to a toothache, oh, yes, I'm groveling at the floor because of my toothache.
Stephanie Ramos joining us, an advocate and a patient of Dr. Pulsino, who's also with us. And Stephanie was the first Rochesterian to be cured of sickle cell through a bone marrow transplant. And Dr. Pulsino, how do those procedures tend to go?
So to engage in a bone marrow transplant for sickle cell disease, Steph had to engage with our adult hematology oncology team and with the support of a pediatric hematologist oncologist at U of R. Dr. Jeff Andalina leads that work at the University of Rochester. He is a pediatric hematologist in the Golisano Children's Hospital, and he supported her through the bone marrow transplant process. So we did it as a team. As Stephanie said, I was there as her medical doctor with our team from the Complex Care Center. And Dr. Andalina really led the charge to support her and her twin brother in engaging in first chemotherapy. For Stephanie, we had to kill all the bone marrow in her body that was making the cells the wrong way. So just like somebody with cancer, she had to go through that same process. We had to get rid of the cells that were doing it the wrong way, that were creating those sickle cells. And that was a very long, arduous process for her, just like someone going through it for cancer treatment. She then had to get cells, blood cells, that are called stem cells, the ones that are the thinkers before they become blood in your body, from her brother, transplanted to her bones. And then her bones had to be supported and her body had to heal so she could make her own cells from that bone marrow, those stem cells. So essentially her body had to reboot. It's kind of like a hard set on a computer. We had to get rid of all the old bone marrow cells that were making it the wrong way, get them from her brother, and then help her body recover so she could make them without sickle cells.
Absolutely amazing. What is the success rate for this kind of procedure?
That is a very good question, Evan. It is not one that's done often, and I can't tell you that rate. It is very rarely done for an adult because of the antibodies that develop after years of exposure to blood products, mm-hmm. which is why we are doing research into other options to cure the disease.
Yeah. I guess, were you confident that it would work when you did it?
Oh, I am confident in Stephanie and her family. So I had no doubt that this was the right choice for her and where she was at the time. It was definitely worth the risk that she was about to incur.
What an amazing story. I mean, boy, oh boy. What can be done is so remarkable. Stephanie, how are you doing today? Really week to week, month to month, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm healthier. Sickle cell left its marks in certain ways, but that's okay. I always say everything is doable now. Before, it was harder. Now it's doable. I plan to go back to school to further educate myself with patient advocacy because my heart desire is to be able to help patients and families with sickle cell and give them the tools they need and also be the voice for them when they feel like they might not be able to speak up in the medical field.
Well, now you know Stephanie's story, and in a moment here, we're going to get back to what brought us together for this conversation, which is the subject of vaccination. Who gets it? Where is it accessible? Where is it not? And whether this rollout has been inclusive of people who not only might have disabilities, but also complex medical conditions that might make them more vulnerable to COVID. And what's happening in this community, thanks to the Dr. Pulsinos and the Michelle Labossiere Halls and these organizations that are doing this work, it's undoubtedly saving lives and helping people. And when we come back here, we're going to get right back to how that's happening. So in a moment, we return with Dr. Tiffany Pulsino, a professor of internal medicine and pediatrics at the University of Rochester Medical Center, medical director of the UR Medicine Complex Care Center, Michelle Labossiere Hall, associate vice president of customized support at Heritage Christian Services. And you're hearing Stephanie Ramos is with us, an advocate, a patient of Dr. Pulsino, someone who's, as she said, living with the effects of sickle cell, but a remarkable story of a cure. And she's getting her second dose of a COVID vaccine this afternoon. We're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, the story of donor-conceived children and one family, 28 adults spread across the United States and other countries who did not know they were related. Four who went to high school together and didn't know they were related. Now, they're finding each other as adults. But it's not all a happy ending. The changes they want to see made to the rules regarding donor conception. That story Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I got a question from a listener, Dr. Pulsino, about thalassemia. Is that a term? I don't know the term. Is that a condition that you treat?
Yes, thalassemia is a blood condition. It's another genetic mutation that results in a blood condition. You can have both thalassemia and sickle cell disease. It's just a different mutation on the gene that makes blood cells.
Okay.
A little different effects from it.
Yeah. Dennis in Pittsford says, my sister-in-law has inherited a thalassemia gene. With so many people in this area having Mediterranean ancestry, could you compare the prevalence, disease, and treatment of thalassemia with that of sickle cell? Dennis is wondering.
So thalassemia in general is a more common genetic mutation. It has a variety of impacts as in a person, because there's a variety of different severities of thalassemia. So he's absolutely right. There is a high prevalence of Mediterranean ancestry in the upstate region. So there are a lot of people with this genetic mutation, but there's also a lot of different ways that the disease can display itself. Some people can have thalassemia and sickle cell, and that looks very different than somebody with one genetic mutation for thalassemia.
Okay. Dennis, good luck to you. When we think about people like Stephanie, doctor, who have sickle cell, someone with sickle cell, are they more vulnerable to COVID?
So, yes. So people with sickle cell disease, because they've had long-term damage to multiple organs from the disease itself, they're already kind of going in with their deck down. Their card deck has lost some cards already. So just like every other pre-morbid condition that can cause complications from sickle cell or from COVID-19 and put you at higher risk, sickle cell disease is one of those. We've had lots of national conversations and calls about that. We're seeing a higher rate of complications, especially in the lung with breathing because of the damage done from sickle cell when people are getting older.
Well, let me ask all of our guests now about how this rollout has been happening with the vaccines as we head into April. And, you know, certainly the vaccine supply has changed availability. But when you think about the overall rollout, let me start with Dr. Pulsino here. Do you think, I guess I want to ask you if you think it's been equitable. And I think what would have happened if you hadn't been able to work with the Heritages, and there's so many other organizations that are doing what you're doing for these mobile clinics. If you hadn't intervened that way, would it have been equitable? Can you give me a sense of what you think about the rollout?
I think the rollout is going as well as it can because we have really good people trying to lead and be flexible. It has been quite a journey to build up an infrastructure of healthcare delivery that needed to happen within weeks, only to experience every week not knowing how many you're going to get, have the regulations change, have the state mandates change. So the people in the leadership positions that are managing that rollout have really done the best they can, and they've given a lot of permission and support for innovation to make sure that people have access to the vaccine in a real way. So what would have happened if there wasn't this mobile team? I'm confident that someone else would have stepped forward as the community advocated with the voices they always have to make sure that this population gets access to care. So because the upstate region has such collaborative voices and is the vaccination hub has been so supportive of innovation and delivery, it really was the perfect petri dish to do this well. It's just an impossible situation to manage and stand up when you don't have a public health infrastructure in the United States that was ready for it.
Michelle Labossiere-Hall from Heritage Christian Services, what do you make of the overall vaccine rollout?
I, first of all, would like to express gratitude for our community champion here with Dr. Pulsino. She is right. We do have a very collaborative community, but without someone of her stature and passion to help lead this, I don't think we would be as far as we are. These clinics have allowed greater accessibility and equitable distribution, particularly for those with intellectual and developmental disabilities and for their staff. Our agencies are experiencing staffing crisis, so being able to schedule on a website, know that you had the staff to transport, know that you had enough staff back at the group home, to take somebody to an unfamiliar situation, just the number of complications in navigating that type of system, all of that barrier was removed by allowing the provider to work with directly with Dr. Pulsino's team and help to coordinate that. And that is a big part of the success. The teams that have come have spent a lot of time in education, which has improved, I think, some of the vaccine confidence, taking away a little bit of the hesitancy. I know I have observed staff who have said, no, I'm not ready, but they have been present and have supported other people through getting their vaccination and have since said, okay, you know what, I think I'm ready now. I've come to these clinics. I've watched other people. I've sat and listened to Dr. Pulsino and her team explain what it is I'm going to experience, and that really goes a long way.
I think that's so important, and I'm really glad you brought that up, Michelle, because, you know, especially early in the pandemic, when it was mostly healthcare workers and people who were nursing home residents being vaccinated, there were some reports that, well, you know, 70% of healthcare workers are getting vaccinated, or 80%. And, you know, those of us in the public were looking at saying 20 to 30%, that many people, even who work in healthcare, are hesitant. And to me, it was a reminder to be very careful and to really do a better job, not shaming, not mocking, knowing that people from all walks of life, all backgrounds, may have their own reasons for saying, I'm going to wait. But it sounds like what you're seeing, Michelle, is that as they see it up close, more comfort comes? Does that help?
Absolutely helps. Absolutely helps. And, you know, even if I didn't show up for a vaccine today, but I was assisting someone to be able to see the process and to ask questions for myself as well as the person that I'm supporting, that has been impactful.
Dr. Pulsino, have you seen colleagues in the medical profession at really any level or any part of the organization, have you seen some of the hesitation or resistance wane over the last 3 months?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, people have, as you said, Evan, it's important not to shame or deride people who have said, I need to wait, I want to see what's going to happen. Because as more research has come out and we take time to educate people about what we now know, that is going away, that is decreasing significantly. And people deserve the opportunity to really understand things in a way that they're comfortable with before they engage in a new healthcare treatment. And that's perfectly reasonable. But it's our job as healthcare providers and researchers and community collaborators to really provide that education in an accessible way. So I think part of the value the mobile vaccine team brought was making it accessible to people, that education in a setting they were comfortable in, that they could access, that they didn't have to take time off work to engage in, and they could trust because it was people that they knew were taking care of their recipients on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I mean, you know, I got vaccinated in at the state fairgrounds, and, you know, they give you a sheet. And right there on the bottom of the sheet, it says, I mean, I don't remember the exact language, but it says something like, this is a vaccine that is not approved by the CDC or something like that. And I can imagine thousands of people sitting there with that sheet going, well, then what did I just get? Or people who have not gotten the vaccine yet hearing about that. And I only bring that up because that does not mean, anyone listening, that does not mean this is not a safe or vetted vaccine. These vaccines are not only really successfully vetted, but are among some of the most successful we have ever seen. I mean, a year ago, there was talk about 18 months at best, and if we could get one that was 50 to 60% effective, great, we would take it, you know, just as we take it with the flu. I mean, these are so much better than that. They're so much better than that. But it was just, sometimes it's the minutiae of the language or the just sort of the complexity of the language. And you can understand why people are on the fence. So I just have so much love and appreciation for what Dr. Pulsino and Michelle have mentioned there. And it's a good reminder to me to continue to be patient with people in my own life and with listeners and with anybody, because people have legitimate questions. The questions are fair. Stephanie Ramos, did you ever find yourself thinking, I don't know if I want this vaccine, or did you say, the second I got a chance, I'll get it?
So, yeah, so in the beginning, I did have some uncertainty about certain things, but, you know, the communication was there with me and Dr. Pulsino and her team. When I had questions, she answered them. And the more questions she answered, the more I felt okay. I also always feel like that type of person to go ahead of the team in a sense of, why not I do it, being a transplant recipient, to say, hey, I did it. And I'm okay, and it's going to be okay. So that way, you know, maybe it might help another. Once again, the ladies were stating how we shouldn't shame others and just inform each other and allow each other to make, you know, their own personal decisions. So I figured, why not me? And then if my actions puts, you know, courage in someone else to go, okay, she did it, she was fine, then why not? You know, why not?
Well said, and I know people will appreciate your advocacy in that way, Stephanie. Dr. Pulsino, you mentioned that the vaccine task force, of which we've had the co-directors on this program many times, and we hope to have them back soon, they were very supportive, it sounds like, when you raised this possibility. Did you have any issues with red tape anywhere to do these clinics?
I think there's always issues with red tape when it comes to a distribution like this that's managed by the state government, but that red tape was managed by the hub. They did a beautiful job in coordinating. It is a hour-by-hour, 24/7 work that they're doing to make sure that vaccines are distributed equitably, to make sure that they're used rapidly, that the people who are engaged and ready to receive can receive them, and those that maybe aren't engaged and ready to receive them get the opportunities in a setting where they're comfortable. So there's lots of red tape, but that Finger Lakes Vaccination Hub and the leadership within it has been managing that
with stamina that I cannot even muster and cannot imagine. They've been doing a beautiful job.
Yeah, we always appreciate having a chance to get updated from them. And we will do that for listeners soon, just sort of opening up to listeners for questions on the next stages in vaccination, because we're moving now and things are changing almost week by week in New York State, different standards in different states. So we'll continue to answer those questions. Now, on the subject of gaps in general, it's one thing to work on vaccination. It's another to make sure that there are support services. People might feel isolated or disconnected in various ways. Michelle, what have you seen with that in the last 12 months, generally speaking, and what is Heritage's role there?
I think all providers are doing the best we can, Evan. You know, we're charged with care for people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So health and safety, first priority there. And because of that, people have really been isolated. They've been isolated to their homes. They haven't been going into their community. They haven't been going to their work. They haven't been going to their rehabilitation programs. So they have been more isolated than I know I have been and probably you have been. I mean, that's frankly taking a toll on people. So with vaccination, you know, hopefully additional freedoms come, and now our community positivity rate is significantly lower, and some of those programming options are opening up. But we still have a ways to go, but we're getting there little by little. It's definitely a sign of hope.
What has been the hardest thing about providing services in these last 12 months, Michelle?
Probably the isolation. The greatest risk to the people that we support in any congregate setting is the staff that come and go with the best intentions to provide the best support, but they likely are out and about and then potentially could expose somebody that they are working with. So that's been a challenge, and with the staffing crisis being as it is, it's an added layer of burden there.
Well, and if you can just elaborate a little bit on this, Michelle, this is still something that we hear often, but we heard this right from the jump and heard it all throughout the last year, which was something along the lines of let everybody go about their lives and just protect the vulnerable. But what you're describing in various facilities is not a perfectly closed system and ecosystem, you know, of staff, of facilities managers, people who are in and out of the building. What did you make of it when people were saying, well, just go about, let all of us go about our business and we'll just protect the vulnerable?
Well, what I make of it is it is our responsibility, right, to protect. And took a lot of effort to do that initially by looking at different staffing models, having only certain people work in certain programs, increasing the length of shift. A lot of that happened very much, very necessary at the beginning. And as we learned more and we acquired the PPE to help protect people, we were able to change some of the things that we put in place initially.
Yeah, I think it strikes me that there isn't an easy way to just automatically, we'll protect the vulnerable and then the rest of society continues functioning as normal and then we'll be contained. Because food goes in and out, shipments go in and out, staff have to go in and out of facilities, it sounds to me. Fair enough?
Yes.
Dr. Pulsino, what have you seen in the last 12 months when it comes to maybe important lessons learned about making sure that those who are vulnerable, whether it's complex medical conditions, people who live in congregate settings, et cetera, that the gaps are met as best they can in a crisis?
So I think we've learned, I don't think people like Michelle and I have learned anything new. I think what the pandemic has done is it's shining a spotlight on the gaps we already knew existed. Mm-hmm. So things like those people that Michelle's referring to, the staff in these group homes that have been in the trenches with the healthcare workers, caring for people with COVID-19 to the best of their ability, sometimes without PPE that they needed because of supply, they're not paid well. They don't get the level of reimbursement that they should to be able to support those individuals. They do an amazing job, and they're committed to providing great care, but they are underpaid and under-resourced to do that the way that they need to be. And the gaps in resources for people in crisis, which Michelle and I were very aware of before the pandemic, when you don't have access to community engagement and you're further isolated, those gaps in crisis management are highlighted, and more patients and people with IDD and other disabilities show up in the emergency room or other settings that can't deal with those crisis events because it's not the perfect setting for them. So I'm not sure that we learned anything new, but there's a lot of spotlight being shown on the gaps that we had before the pandemic and a lot more attention and engagement in trying to solve them. So things like staffing deficits and being able to staff appropriately so that you're ready for the next crisis or the next challenging event, as opposed to having to react to it, is a really important gap that we need to fill, both in healthcare and community-based settings where we're supporting individuals with disabilities.
Does that mean, by the way, Dr. Pulsino, that we need laws to mandate that?
Mandating additional support?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure if it's a law or a budgetary requirement in New York State that we are able to increase staffing ratios and ensure that those staff receive a reasonable wage. I'll defer to Michelle to answer that question. It's definitely more her wheelhouse. What I can tell you is that you cannot respond to crisis on an already overextended staffing model or healthcare system. It is very challenging when you're just asking people to do more for over a year.
Sure. You want to add to that, Michelle?
I 100% agree that it would be in the rate structure to support that staff. Absolutely. We need to be able to support a staffing structure that allows those folks a livable wage. It is absolutely rewarding work, but it is difficult work. And when someone potentially can go to a fast food establishment or somewhere, a grocery store, and earn a couple dollars more an hour, that is often what someone might choose. And we had a staffing crisis prior to the pandemic, to Dr. Pulsino's point, but then you experience a pandemic where people have their own anxiety or medical issues or other reasons why they might not be able to come to work that day. It just highlighted an already vulnerable point.
Mm-hmm. Let me just squeeze in a couple more questions. Listeners, Bob in Rochester wants to know, if the treatment for sickle cell could be used for people with ALS. Dr. Pulsino, do you know anything about that?
That is a very interesting question because they are both genetically based. So the technology to decide or to discover therapies that could target genes is similar for any genetic condition, but the treatments are different. But that research and how to identify gene therapies is a very robust research field that the NIH is supporting across the United States, and it will have impacts on many, many diseases in the next few decades, ALS being one of them.
Okay. On the subject of these mobile clinics, Dr. Pulsino, is there more work to be done with them? What's the status?
So the mobile clinics, based in our community collaboration with multiple organizations, some of which you listed earlier in the show, Evan, will be completed May 3rd for their second dose of vaccine. We've moved from group home settings to those in community-based settings that need to open during the day. So day habs, vocational training, school-based settings, so those with IDD can return to those community settings and be less isolated. Those will finish May 3rd.
Okay. And Stephanie Ramos, as we wrap up with you here, you know, I know you said you, when you became an adult with sickle cell and you met more people who have gone through what you've gone through, now you're, you know, you certainly know a network of people who've been through some similar experiences. What has been the reaction to vaccination? Are generally speaking, are you seeing some success in reaching people and convincing people to decide to go ahead and get vaccinated?
So from what I'm seeing through the social media platforms, it's a mixture, mm-hmm. as well in the community of what to do. I personally, you know, everybody has their reasons into why they want to get the vaccination or don't. I just blatantly say, you know, you're already have a compromised immune system as is. You know, you're already coming in with decks, missing cards. COVID is something really serious that unfortunately can't take your life. So I always think rather be on the safe side. But even in the sickle cell community, there's still mixed feelings about. But once again, I just tell people do as much digging, into your heart's desire of getting answered questions of from your providers and so forth. Like I said, what helped me was Dr. Pausino of the many questions I had for her, and it made me comfortable enough to say, okay, I'm ready to do this. So I'm hoping that that's what's going to happen within the sickle cell community and just in the community as a whole, as we continue to go on with the vaccination throughout the United States.
Yeah, amen. Stephanie Ramos, as an advocate and a patient and a survivor of sickle cell, here's to continued good health and good luck to you. And thank you for the work you do for our community, Stephanie.
Thank you so much, Evan.
The remarkable Dr. Tiffany Pausino, who is the medical director of the UR Medicine Complex Care Center, has been with us. Thank you for making the time, doctor. And here's to so much more great work happening in this community. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
And Michelle Labassier-Hall, Associate Vice President of Customized Support at Heritage Christian Services. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
This interview is part of WXXI's Inclusion Desk, spotlighting issues related to disabilities. The WXXI Inclusion Desk is part of Move to Include, a partnership to encourage thoughtful discussion about issues of inclusion and the differently abled. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful weekend if you can. We're back with you next week on Member Supported Public Radio.